So I'm going to talk about nanopore sequencing, a little bit about how it works, and then talk about what we use it for. We try to exploit a couple of the unique features of sequencing. One of them is that it's portable. It's definitely now almost everywhere that you can imagine doing sequencing has now been done. This is sort of a Twitter meme almost, and that's getting a bit embarrassing. This is, we've done sequencing. This is on a beach, a brewery. We've done it at a bakery. It's been done in Svalbard, 78 degrees north. And I think this is actually quite a cool application, because this is an example of sampling in the field, making a decision based on that data, and then moving somewhere else, rather than, which is a lot more efficient than collecting samples, analyzing them, and then realizing that you needed to go somewhere else, that sort of thing. So I think this is quite a good one. This is Arwen Edwards at Ryswyth in Wales. This is a NASA underwater test laboratory called the Aquarius, I think, that's off the coast of Florida. This is at 25 meters under the sea, and someone's doing some tests there. Now this is the big one. So sequencing has now been done on the ISS. If you've heard about this in the news, the instrument is so small and requires any USB power that they were able to actually do that for the first time. All the other instruments that have been used before that are very large and often require a lot of support equipment. So this is the first time this has really been feasible to launch this up, where every gram costs money. And they were doing some basic sequencing here. This was actually a library that was made on Earth and then transported up, frozen, and then thawed out. So it really only proved that the MinION can sequence in zero G, which is obvious anyway, because you can turn upside down and it works.
I always felt it was pretty silly that pipetting works on the ISS. It's sort of more news than sequencing.
This is a lot of hype, really. I think probably the most useful thing about this test was that it was able to survive a rocket launch and the vibrations associated with that. It's probably as far as it goes. And this is my portable lab that I used for surveillance sequencing of Ebola during the West Africa outbreak. And this is all the gear that I took. This is Heathrow, and that was all the equipment that I needed to set up the lab there in Guinea. And this is my actual clothes, so it's only those two bags with me. So what do you need to set up a mobile lab for doing portable sequencing? The first thing you need is a MinION. As I said, it's the only real practical sequencer that you can use in the field. It's a very cheap to produce instrument, unlike all the others. The capital cost of the instrument is $1,000 to get started, and they give you a MinION device, a couple of flow cells, and a library prep kit to get started. The actual consumable is the main cost. It's a sort of vending machine model where you get where it costs about $500 per run to do, but the actual instrument is effectively free. This is the consumable part on top, so it clips on, and then this has got an FPGA and a USB bridge in, basically. It doesn't do that much. So the flow cell surface in this part here, this is called the array. That's 2,000 wells in a grid arrangement, and each one of those wells has a sequencing core, if you like, with a membrane over a well, and so this is an insulating membrane with a nanopore embedded in the membrane, and some salty buffer, electrophys buffer on top and below. It's 80 millimolar potassium chloride, something like that. And as you apply a bias voltage, then the ions can only flow through the middle of the nanopore. If you then put a DNA strand in the nanopore, it blocks the ion flow in a characteristic way. Characteristic in that the level of the signal is caused by the amount of blocking or the conformation of the DNA molecule inside the actual nanopore. So that's how you get these different signal levels. And from that, you can then convert that signal level into bases. So the way that the base calling works is you actually have more than one base inside the barrel of the nanopore. It can probably about six bases are within the actual barrel of the nanopore, but the biggest contributors to the signal level are the ones at the tightest point. So there's one base or two bases which provide more, have more effect on the signal levels than the others, because they're at that constriction point, so they block more ion flow. And as the bases go through, they contribute to other signals. So actually, it calls chamers, not bases, the base caller, because of the way this has to work. And you observe the base at each position as it slides through. So you get a small contribution to the signal, but you get to observe that base multiple occasions. You can actually do it up to 10 times if you sequence both the template and the complement. So the readout are these samples of current, which are sampled at 6,000 Hertz. And if you have four bases with five mer word length, you can have 1,024 signal levels, and the dynamic range of those is about 35 picoamps. So it depends on the pore and the membrane and all these sorts of things. But effectively, if they were perfectly distributed, you would have sort of 0.2 picoamp separation between each signal level. But they're not evenly distributed. They have this sort of shape here, so they're more likely to be around 70 picoamps. So it makes the base calling quite difficult. And what they actually measure here is the signal level mean and the standard deviation of these things. And the terminology is raw and then events. If you fitted an event to a linear to the actual data.
Can we go back for a second?
Yep.
So this looks quite spectacular, right? There are no these black dot samples of climbing the stairs from one level to the other. Does that happen very often?
Well, this is quite challenging in itself, because you can see that there's a lot of noise, and it's like, is this a real event? Is that a real event? These sorts of things. So
I would imagine sort of a lot more continuous signal, right? It is sampled very rapidly.
Yeah. Do you mean that if you sample slower, you have a less noisy signal? No.
I think what he means is that it has to jump from one base to the next, rather than transitioning smoothly, because then you'd expect to see smooth variation in the current. So that the thing's held there five bases, then it jumps one.
It's enzymatically controlled, so I suppose it does have that.
So it actually discreetely then clicks on the time scale of fraction of a millisecond from one position to the next.
Yeah. So this is what they call the motor protein. So it sits on top of the pore and makes this protein pore complex. And this is a helicase, so it unzips the DNA. And you end up with one strand being fed through here, and then one staying in the cis compartment. But the this basically slows down. It acts like a brake and provides that sort of processivity. If you didn't have the motor protein slowing it down, it would go through the pore at about a million bases a second, they say, go with the ion clip. So this actually slows it down, and they control the speed by titrating the level of ATP, so they throttle the enzyme back. The enzyme speed depends on temperature, the buffer, the amount of ATP, those sorts of things. So it's actually, this one, the current version, it runs at 450 bases a second, but previous versions of chemistry run at different speeds. So it's increasing generally over time.
And that rate is independent of what the pentamer are going through?
Not entirely, no. So to add even more complexity, the context within the motor affects the speed going down here, which is then observed at this point. So it's quite complex.
But you have no way of seeing the enzyme click. Right?
You can actually see the enzyme click. They call it ticks. So in some versions of the chemistry and some with some motors, you can see these little ticks between the events, which is what you were saying. You're basically observing the enzyme kinetics.
You see from the data, but there's no way of putting an extra sort of measurement on that that'll tell you Because no. you can already see why homopolymer runs are going to give you trouble, right?
So they thought that enzyme tips might be the answer to homopolymer problems, because you just count tips. Uh-huh. But in practice, they found it very difficult to make it tick and detect that tick robustly. So the new method is that if you find an enzyme which has a nice gamma distributed dwell time, then you just measure the amount of dwell time, and then you infer the homopolymer length from that. So that's their new strategy, and it's not very. It works to a degree, but it's not very accurate. So there's been a very rapid development of the technology. So it was launched in May 2014, and then with an error rate of about 32%, something like that. And it's increased very rapid chemistry iterations to the system we have now, which is R9.4 or R9.5 at 450 bases a second. And it can generate between 90 and 95% raw read accuracy. So raw read accuracy is not necessarily the same as the sort of consensus accuracy. I'll come back to that in a minute. So 1D and 2D means you're either just reading the template strand or you're reading the template and the complement strand. And there was the initial version of the chemistry added a hairpin onto one end so that you see just one strand and then the other one followed it through. The new version uses an affinity tag such that the complement is more likely to enter the pore next after the template than an unrelated molecule. They were sued by Pat Bio, so they had to get rid of the hair thing. So this is some data from PoreChem, which is a course we run in the UK, workshop really for learning nanopore. And last year we were getting 1 gig, 2 gig sort of runs. We've just recently published a preprint sequencing human genome, and the yield is typically above 2 gigs now. These are earlier flow cells with worse quality DNA, and then we're getting up to sort of 4.5 gigs or so, four above for the best runs on this version of the chemistry. So the yield is improving as well over time. The best run that we've ever done in house is 9.8 gigs, so it's getting towards MiSeq yield. But obviously you have much fewer longer reads.
How long does it run?
You can run it for, it's undefined. So you can run it for as little or as long as you want, depending on how much data you need and how long the flow cell is holding up. So you get, at the start, you have the most number of pores and they're most active. And over time, as the buffer conditions sort of degrade and you lose pores and they collapse or the membranes burst, you end up with less sequencing capacity. So you effectively have a diminishing return so the longer you run it.
But for 2 gigs, it's roughly how long?
2 gigs, you could do that in 6 hours on a good run.
Thank you.
On a really good run. And in terms of read length, this is a transposase library prep kit, which means it's enzymatically tagmented. It fragments it and inserts an oligo. The read lengths that we were getting were, they have this long tail distribution, but there were sort of 10,000. The longer reads were about 10,000 bases or longer. And a year later, using some tweaks, so we're using phenyl chloroform prep DNA now, and increasing the input massively, trying to saturate the reaction so you get one insertion per molecule, we now increase this by 10 times, and there's a decent number of reads above 200,000 bases, and the top reads are approaching 1 million. I've never actually hit 1 million, I've been trying very hard, but I've never actually achieved 1 million reads yet. So the longest, we have this whale watching scale, which is where you basically take the weight of the whale in kilograms and just have that as basis. So we got the narwhal. We got an 882,000 base pair read, which actually had a 950,000 base pair alignment because there's so many deletions in it. that's pretty much more deletions than the longest ever papilloma. So it's an amazing scaffolding instrument when you use it in this sort of mode, and I thought it was quite cool. So I currently do have the Reed-length record for the Minnow, and I thought that was quite cool. But then I remembered I do also have the Illumina Reed-length record from back in 2012, 678 bass pairs on my signature. This is to demonstrate what effect these reeds could have or will have on genome assembly. And obviously, it's absolutely pointless generating reeds from E. coli that are over 500,000 base pairs long, when you only need 7,000 base pairs long to get a single quantity assembly. But for the purposes of pushing the technology, we did a minimal assembly. So we cherry-picked these reeds from a few runs and worked out that we could assemble E. coli from 8 reeds in 1.5 seconds into a single contig, using reeds of about 800,000 base pairs each on average, which are taking about 30 minutes to translocate the pore. So each of those reeds took 30 minutes to translocate the pore at 450 base pairs per second. So it's quite a long time, even at that speed, it takes quite a long time to sequence a molecule. So if you were going to get to the million, it would be about 37 minutes. And this is the assembly graph. So what else do you, that was a bit of a segue. So what else do you need for portable sequencing? You need some lab equipment. Unfortunately, at the moment, there's still no way of avoiding taking lab equipment. So in this box, I had a PCR machine, and I also had a styrofoam container with a bit of cold chain, some PCR reagents, and the MinION flow cells, the MinION library prep kit. And the way I do it is I just put some frozen cold packs on top in the box, put the lid on, tape it up, put it in the bag, and then just fly there. And as soon as I get there, I unpack it into a fridge. So you're still relying on having a freezer on the other side as well when you arrive. But generally speaking, it's pretty portable, and you only really need a few bits of labware to set up a sort of minimal lab when you get there. These are obviously the sort of consumables, magnetic rack, and the fluorimeter, a couple of laptops. It's not a massive amount of stuff. And at the time, he was a sort of competitor, but actually we were really good friends with him now. This guy, Ian Goodfellow from Cambridge, wanted to take an iron torrent to Sierra Leone, and that is the amount of equipment that he had to take over on a 5-ton truck using the UK military supply routes from quite a different managed to get all this equipment out there. And that's how much gear you need to do iron torrent sequencing as a comparison. So that was actually probably the more sensible thing to do. It was a fairly tried and tested technology compared to what we were doing. So we were being a bit more risky. So there's this analogy that my PhD supervisor Mark Pallon coined, called the Rumsfeld matrix. And Donald Rumsfeld famously said there are things we know, and there are things that we know that we don't know, and that is quite a good analogy to distinguish targeted and untargeted sequencing methodologies. So if you want to observe something that you know about, you can use culture enrichment, PCR enrichment. You can design an assay basically that's specific to what you're looking for. But the holy grail is really metagenomics, where you can find things that you don't even know about based on a completely untargeted assay. And that is difficult, because in order to do that, you have to take the whole nucleic acid content of your sample as a whole and sequence it in its abundances that it occurs in the sample, whereas all of these other things are designed to enrich the thing that you're looking for, to make the sequencing easier, more on target, that sort of thing. So this is very hard, especially for clinical sequencing, because the human genome is massive. So if you have one bacterial cell and one human cell, then you have like 10 to the 8 more reads from the human, Maple's human, than you would from the bacteria. So this is what we're working towards. This experiment here was we wanted the minimum, we were trying to generate the minimum amount of data, because we're using a completely untested technology. So we went for a PCR enrichment approach, which is that was sort of easiest in this sort of way. And the way that we decided to do that, it's quite old school, so it's a retro gel here. The Ebola gene is about 20 kb, and we designed these PCR primers, which meant that we could either use a 19, a 40, a 20, or a 10 reaction scheme to tile across the genome. So we do those all in individual PCRs, pull them together, and then sequence them. And then gradually we got better at doing this, such that we could, 11 reactions cover 98.4% of the genome. 11 reactions. The Y scale shows the depth of reads, and that is a little bit unbalanced. It depends on how well you normalize your pools when you actually sequence them. And once we've got these amplicons, we then use a ligation type ligand-prep method. And that basically means taking your amplicons and adding an A tail, which basically is a single base pair overhang. And that means you can ligate on a T-tailed adapter without getting concatenomers. That's like the most common way of doing adapter ligation in sequencing ligand construction. And you sequence the whole amplicon from start to finish. The other type of method, which is commonly done for nanopore, and it's the one that generates the long reads, which I showed earlier, is this enzymatic method called transposase. And it basically is you prime the enzyme with some oligos, and it forms called the transposasome complex, and it inserts itself randomly into DNA and attaches the oligo that it was holding onto the ends. And that means that you can set up the AA overhang in advance, basically, and have a very rapid ligand prep, which takes only 5 minutes. So it's quite cool, but it's not appropriate for amplicon sequencing, because you would lose the ends of the amplicon because it inserts into the molecule. You also need to have some way of doing some kind of bioinformatics pipeline for analyzing the data that you generate in the field. When we were in West Africa, we didn't actually analyze the data in the field. We had our initial system, we used the hotel Wi-Fi to upload the data. We investigated using satellite data connections, but they're really expensive. It's something like a megabyte, something like that. And we were uploading 500 megs per run, so it would have been more expensive than the flow cell itself. In the end, we settled for these. It's just a 3G hotspot, actually, this TP-Link one, which the WHO gave us. And I basically went around, bought SIM cards, and topped them all up and tested the data speed connections, and we found one that was sort of passable. And we were able to upload the 500 megs that we needed to the servers in Birmingham to analyze. Nowadays, there's two different ways you can analyze. You can do your base calling. So you generate your reads on the laptop, and then you can either choose to run local base calling, and that now involves neural network base caller. There's one called Minnow Live, there's one called AlbaCore, there's one called Deep Nano. There's a not really used anymore HMM one called NanoCore. And there's also a cloud platform which Oxford Nanopore make called MetriCore, and the less said about that, the better, really. It's a bit like base space for nanopore sequencing. So you have some reads, and in this version of the chemistry, which is R9, I think it's R9. You have some distribution of accuracy that at this point in time was about 80, which had was about 80 to 85%, something like that. And they have randomly distributed errors which occur from base calling errors. And like PacBio, you can use a simple consensus algorithm to remove the randomly occurring errors. And the way that we did this at the time was using partial order graphs, and you basically align more reads to the graph and create these extra nodes if you need them, but then you take the thickest path through the graph to remove the random errors, and you end up with one pass of this at 96, 97% accurate read or consensus read, and then if you do it twice, you can remove even more, get sort of 98, 99% accurate reads just by removing the random errors.
Wait, can you comment quickly on what your take is on Deep Nano versus AlbaCore versus Minnow?
So if you run them, they all give different results. some slightly better than the other. Some are slightly better. Probably the most developed is albacore. Therefore, it probably gives the best results. So it's the nanopore. Actually, even themselves, confusingly, had about three different base callers in parallel for a while, and even albacore was giving different results if you ran it on GPU and CPU, and it was a mess. Now it's getting to it's getting reasonably good. The released version of albacore. So I would recommend not running the Minnow base calling, but then installing albacore and running it on the laptop, on the set, and doing it locally.
And how different were the results? Are we talking about?
There's like a big from between the best and the worst base caller. There's probably like more than 10% difference.
And are those biased then? Do some have more indels? Some have more.
I didn't really know about the error profiles of the different base callers. I think it's so they all use the same even if they have different training data, I guess, as well. Because and with the HMM based caller, with the RNN based callers, it's all to do with the quality of the training data. So they had slightly different architectures for the neural network and things like that, and different parameters, slightly different parameters and that sort of thing. But now it's all converging reasonably well. And people don't really use any of the other base callers now. It's just albacore.
Well, Minnow most people probably.
Some people use Minnow, yeah. Minnow, the desire is it was to have the Minnow base caller app as the same as albacore, but for some reason they've never really managed to package up the current albacore version in Minnow. It just seems to lag behind. I think it's because Minnow has to go through software testing. So they put in the current version, then they put it through software testing, and then by the time it comes out, it's out of date compared to the albacore version you can get.
Is there given that this is some complicated black box?
Yeah.
So is there some worry what would worry me about that is that I don't know now how to statistically model the probability.
It is worrying. I think it's worrying. It's basically prone to overfitting and overtraining, and because you get effectively the way it works now is if you train your data on E. coli, you'll get best results from E. coli. If you train your results on yeast, you get best results from yeast. They try to have a training data set which encompasses all of the sequence context that you can find. So they have to, so that bacteria don't really, or E. coli doesn't really include all that context, so they go slightly larger. I think they train it on yeast or a mixture of yeast and E. coli. But it's definitely, I think it's definitely a worry. Yeah. But the problem is that it was found that that neural network base callers gave at least 10% higher accuracy because they don't quite understand they don't quite know how to model the system well enough with an HMM. So therefore you get this huge advantage from changing to neural network and now you can't really go back. So we have. You've got your corrected reads if you chose to do that. Nowadays the reads don't really need pre-correcting because if you can get 90% identity reads, you can just feed them straight into an assembler. So that's not strictly true. Before we were pre-correcting and then feeding them into Celera. Now Adam Phillippe's group have packaged up Celera in Canoe, which has a map pre-correction step. And MHAP map pre-correction step, and that uses it, and that basically does the correction all in one pipeline. So nowadays, if you wanted to assemble a bacterial or even a bigger genome, you would just put your reads straight into Canoe, and you would get some contigs out like this, and the identity of the contigs to the reference genome would be roughly the same as the pre-corrected reads. So some errors will be corrected in the assembler, but effectively you end up with this residual error. And then you need a polisher so that you can go back to the raw data and try and correct those errors in the assembly. So Jared wrote this program called Nanopolish, and what it basically does is you take your contigs and you map your reads back to your contigs afterwards, and then you basically go across the genome and create these candidate consensus sequences, and you score whether or not the raw events from the original files, what the probability of them supporting that of that consensus is. And you basically choose the best scoring one and then you move on. You just do that iteratively all the way along. And that is quite good at removing some of the residual errors. So he, in this version of the chemistry, you can get, with polishing, you can get up to 99.5. Nowadays, that's more like 99.8.9, something like that. So if you're happy with a 99.8% genome, then you can just use nanopore, really. But if you want to be able to annotate it and have a sort of, you know, perfect genome with all the with all the errors polished out, then you still need a little bit of Illumina data so you can align it to the reads and to the context and use Pylon to polish out the last errors. And the errors are not, the residual errors are not randomly distributed. As you can see, they are particular k-mers that are always called wrong. So in the if you look at the red, that's the draft, and the blue is the reference. If you pre-correction, you have a massive underrepresentation of the homopolymer T and A motifs, and then there's sort of these sort of homopolymer type motifs, which are also underrepresented. And then after correction, you you recover quite a lot of those calls, the poly T, poly A, but now you're slightly overcalling. You know, this poly C, poly G. So it's quite good for some of these other ones. But you still have this, basically you still have this residual homopolymer associated error in the consensus. And different versions of the chemistry, this is improved.
Well, the nanopolish basically fixes what Kanu doesn't do right.
Yeah. By going back to the raw signal and using that information which was used in base calling to then correct final consensus. And over time, the number of SNP errors in the assemblies has decreased very rapidly. So in this version of the chemistry, there's only sort of 200 SNP errors, but you have a much higher number of indel errors residual in the assembly. And then you can combine different pores, and you can use all the different chemistries, and you can get this pretty high. Like Jared's best ever result in his 99.98. He was aiming for Q30. Pat Beyer is probably more like Q40. And if you look at nanopore alignment, you end up with this is an Ebola alignment. You end up with some randomly distributed errors, which you can quite obviously see, and then you end up with this, you can see this real SNP. So some SNPs like this you are quite easy to call, but some, if you have a SNP that's associated with a homopolymer or something like that, this the support or this column might look a lot more messy, and then you actually would need nanopolish to accurately call it. So we, analyzing nanopore data is a lot more complicated than doing in a loop than doing Illumina bioinformatics.
Does the quality degrade along the read as it does in Illumina?
No, it's like PacBio. You have a consistent error rate all the way through. Illumina reads decrease in quality because they work on a cycle chemistry and you lose signal to noise every cycle. With nanopore, you don't have that. But so for doing something you might be able to do in a couple of steps for Illumina, you have to do all of this pipeline for doing nanopore SNP calling.
So I'm a little confused by, so you're talking about specific numbers, you know, 99.8. So this presumably depends on the coverage.
Yeah.
So we're assuming that the coverage is somehow saturated already?
No, I don't have the coverage for this one. I do have the coverage for these ones, so we think that you get most of the benefit by 100x.
Okay. So that's the sort of where the crossover to saturation is.
Yeah, we are writing a paper at the moment where we compare where we're going to look at 1000x of E. coli and subset it and then work out exactly what you just said. So,
I have a question. So, how much does that pipeline and the accuracy and everything change when you're trying to sequence something in novo where you don't have a reference genome?
I think that the problem there is that if you didn't have a reference genome, you wouldn't actually know what your consensus accuracy was for that organism, and it's going to change from organism to organism with GC content with how many methylation systems you have, but you're changing the sort of signal in ways that are not modeled.
But for example, if you take a metagenomic sample, do the nanopore, and then Illumina, and then you take the Illumina reads as the gold standard, how well do they map?
You're just saying if you didn't de novo assemble the bacterial genome and then compared it to an Illumina reference?
I meant more the errors, more than assembly, like the SNPs and the errors.
So it's basically that's basically what those numbers are that I'm trying to show here. But this is effectively a fairly easy genome sequence with 50-50 GC, you know, one or two methylation systems that are fairly infrequently used. You can make this a lot worse by looking at an extreme GC organism, something like that. For our Ebola work, we had a fairly loose brief, or as it were, which was can you go to another country and take this stuff and set it up and do something useful? And this is so I got to West Africa sort of during more towards the tail end of the outbreak in April 2015, and this is a photograph of a safe funeral. But obviously, if you know anything about this was one of the main causes of the spread of Ebola, was unsafe burials. This was taken by this photographer, Tommy Trenchard, who actually came to our lab later on and took some photos. But this was the WHO released what's called the SITREP during any ongoing outbreak, which is the current state of affairs with the epidemiological investigation. And for the first time in October, so this is about 4 or 5 months after we originally showed up there, they used the terminology that genomic analysis suggested that this patient was not infected with the strain, responsible for some of the recent cases in that village. And this is actually this was our data, which we had sent as soon as it was available to the WHO response team, and it was the first time that sequencing data had ever been used in a WHO situation before. So that was how quickly they were willing to adopt that information. So this is where we set up the lab. This is the National Hospital of Conakry, in Donk Hospital in Guinea, and it's built in the 1960s, I think, by the Russians. It was quite rapier by this point. And this was us setting up the first MinION sequencing run in Africa, in Guinea. First Ebola sequencing run ever. So this is Miles from Public Health England and Dr. Masuma, who was working on a vaccine trial in the lab. And our initial first batch of runs, we realised that with the throughput that we were getting from the instrument, we could sequence the Ebola genome with these amplicons to hundreds of X coverage in a matter of minutes. So some of these runs are only running for 30 minutes and there's still more than adequate coverage of the Ebola genome. So really there was so much excess capacity with Ebola that we could have actually done multiplexing on the flow cells and sequenced more. But at the time we just wanted to get the result from one sample as quickly as possible. So you have this cost versus speed type thing that you need to decide what's more important to you. So in this case, we went for speed at any cost. Well, the cost was $500 a genome, because that's we're using a whole flow cell on each one. And we basically monopolised the entire production of flow cells for these months, because they were having production problems, and we had 170 flow cells shipped to Guinea. But the first batch of runs we did, we got this phylogenetic tree out from the first, I think this is like 16 genomes that I did in the first couple of weeks, and we realised that there was two lineages that were present in samples, and this was, at this time, was not known, because the only way of the most recent up-to-date phylogenetic tree for Ebola at the time was samples that were about 5 months out of date, because they had been shipped to back to some big lab, in Liverpool or something, and then it was sequenced, and then they produced a tree, and all that whole process took a very long time. So they didn't actually realize that they had two lineages circulating in Guinea at this time. And by the end of the outbreak, we had our own lab. It moved a couple of times to the most useful place for it to be, but we had this sort of tin lab, and this was when the photographer came and took these pictures, and we'd, by this time, trained local Guinean scientists to do the MinION sequencing as well. This was all in collaboration with the European Mobile Lab, which is an EU grant that have the facility to deploy diagnostic equipment to an outbreak very rapidly. This is a guy called Joseph Boré, who's now doing a PhD in the UK in sequencing, and this is loading the MinION. And this was the view from the lab. So we actually were, at this point in Koya, we're right in the jungle, and you could see out the window that we're right in the jungle. So the results from these are figures from the actual paper that we wrote up. The number of cases that we sequenced by month increased as the epidemic curve was on its way down. So we started sequencing in March, and we gradually got up to a peak of 35 genomes in a month, out of total 54 cases, and that was basically by May we were sequencing all the ones we wanted to. So the ones we didn't sequence were ones where it was very obvious what the transmission route was, like they were family or something like that. So we didn't do all of them, but by the end we were completely saturated it. And this plot shows the time between the date that the blood was drawn and the date that the genome sequence was available. And in some of these cases here, we were 1 or 2 days afterwards, and that really illustrates the power of doing sequencing in country and not having to ship the samples back to somewhere else. And the ones where there was a longer distance between was when we were often requesting RNA from other labs, because the way it was set up, there was lots of different organisations that each had a lab somewhere doing, you know, the diagnostics in that region. And this was often where we requested RNA from other labs and had to be transported over land or dug up from the freezer and then sent here. So a lot of the cases where we had access to the samples, it was practically immediate. You could do the work in about 24 hours. And this is a tree showing all of the 140 genomes, good quality genomes that we published in the paper. And the colour, the colour by the prefecture, which is shown on that map there, and it's effectively got a very clock-like evolutionary rate, and you accumulate mutations over time, and it moves from prefecture to prefecture in this nice branching pattern. So it has about 2 SNPs a month, I think it's something like that. And this is an example of how the epidemiological investigation, which is illustrated like with this block diagram here, this is how we normally do it, was supported perfectly by the genome data, which was that there was someone who was helping at a funeral in Furukawa and then travelled by taxi to this new prefecture, Boké, and then caused this outbreak, which is exactly what they found, which supported the ground epidemiology that had been done in those cases. Oh, what's this rubbish? So this is a tool that Richard and Trevor Bedford wrote called NextFlu, and they very kindly and rapidly created a new site for Ebola, and we were able to upload the genome sequences to NextFlu and show all of the up-to-date data. And these are the two lineages here. This is Sierra Leone 3, which is more basal, and then this is GN1. I think that's the, yeah. It's the way around. That's GN1, and then that's SL3. So that there was a lot more cases in Sierra Leone, and there was a lot more, and then that led to a lot more divergence. And this is our paper we wrote up as a letter to Nature. It's like a ton of authors on here. And we got quite a lot of good press coverage from this. So this is The Guardian, which is the a good newspaper in the UK. This is the University of Birmingham website. And this was only up there for one day because then they put a gravitational waves banner up over it. And we got coverage in The Verge, and this was the big one. Bill Gates tweeted it out. 27 million followers. So that whole project was very successful, and it went better than we could ever have expected. We had managed to do the sequencing in country, and the MinION lived up to our expectations. A lot of people thought that you wouldn't be able to do it, it wouldn't be accurate enough to actually do these genome sequences, but we validated all these sequences again. We validated a set of Illumina sequences, and we found to be 100% concordant once we'd worked through a lot of issues and managed to improve the SNP calling in nanopolish to that level. So it was, by the end, 100% concordant on those six validation samples. But then the Zika outbreak kicked off, and we were compelled to do it all again. And this time we wanted to do it a lot more a lot more cheaply, because there was so many cases, potentially millions of cases of Zika in Brazil. And we wanted to try and improve the methodology that we were using and try and do it a lot quicker. How long have I got, Richard? 12. I can stop whenever you want, really.
Alright, go.
Here you go.
15 minutes.
Okay. So we had some goals for the Zika sequencing, which was that we wanted to sequence 750 genomes at a cost of $50 a genome on MinION, and that was incredibly ambitious in retrospect. And the way that we wanted to do this was by barcoding 12 samples per flow cell, which was the maximum number of native barcodes that there was in the kit, and we wanted to multiplex PCR generate the amplicons. So instead of doing 11 separate PCRs for different regions of the Ebola genome and then quantifying them all and pooling them, we wanted to generate all of the amplicon products in one reaction. So that was what it set about trying to do. This was the this is the team, and we actually were going to go on a sample collection and sequencing road trip across the northeast coast of Brazil. And this was the number of people that we had. There's Trevor there. Of Nick Strain fame, there's me, Nick, and the rest of our Brazilian collaborators. And we had 10 KB. We had four sort of sub-teams. We had a group doing managing the sample database, doing RNA extractions, and they had to do a lot of extractions. There was about five people working on the QIAGEN RNA mini kit for the entire day. And then we were doing PCR, RT-PCR to define positive Zeke samples. And then we were doing, and we had my sequencing subgroup. And then we had a team of entomologists catching mosquitoes. And the way they actually do that is they use human bait, and they just hold their arms out, wait for the mosquitoes to land on them, and they just suck them up with a pooter like that. It would not be allowed by our health and safety officer if they that. So they start off with one arm, and they're like a PhD student, and by the end they've got both arms, both legs. And then we had Nick's group, which is IT and analysis and media coverage. which you enjoyed doing. So the road trip, this is up in Belém in the Amazon region. We actually drove the bus all the way down here, start in Natal, and then we had the road trip went from Natal, Chapecó, Recife, Maceió, and then end up in Salvador. So we travelled 1,000 kilometres by road, I think. And the way that it worked is we went to those cities because they were the capital cities of those regions, and then we went to the public health labs and got them to get all the samples out of the freezer that they had or that they wanted testing. And it by this point there was loads of completely even untested samples that they had taken, but they hadn't had the time to actually or the equipment to actually do So we're pulling them out, doing all the RNA extractions, qPCR, we're finding sort of 10% positivity rate, and then we're trying to sequence those. So for every 100 extractions, we might have had 10 positive Zikas that we could then try and sequence. But we're doing like 1,000 extractions a day by the end. This is everyone working in one of the labs. This is the sequencing library group. These are the entomologists catching mosquitoes. The idea was that if you pulled 100 mosquitoes and do an RNA extraction on that, then you could test that and you could find out whether the mosquitoes from the, that you captured in one place were carrying Zika or not. And you can also identify which species are under a microscope and then pull them by species and by location for testing. There's a nice animation that Nuno made. And the stats for each stop, where we were screening sort of 200, 280, 300, 140, 269 samples, so that means extraction and qPCR, the number of positives, which was around 10%, number of mosquitoes captured, and the number of species of each mosquito. So they were using this, we had some extra metadata from the mosquitoes, which we were trying to collect at the same time. And this is showing the different species that were present in each of the stops. So Aegypti is the main, it's the known vector, but it's possible that there are also other vectors, which is one of the things we were trying to look at. And in terms of the qPCR results, the positivity rate changed by location, but we were looking at an average of about 10%. So in total, we screened 1,400 isolates and had 212 positives. And then we tried to do the sequencing by doing the multiplex PCR that we've been developing, and then loading the amplicons, or making MinION libraries out of the amplicons. This is Nick doing some base calling on the bus. But we ran into a huge challenge, which was that the modal CT values for the positives was CT36 or CT35. And that is a roughly equivalent to about 10 to 100 viral copies per microliter. So it's very, very low. And what we found was that our PCR was failing to amplify enough of the genome in most cases. So the best, so this line represents 50% of the genome, and we only had five samples or six or seven samples which were crossing that line. So we had serious problems amplifying it, and we weren't the only ones. This is Christian Anderson's blog from Scripps, and he's viral sequencing, and they did a MySeq run, an entire MySeq run of a metagenomics sample from a Zika clinical sample, and they got two reads mapping Zika from a whole place off. So this is an example of the difficulty of the metagenomics approach, which I was talking about earlier, where the abundances of the target or the organism of interest are very low compared to the host level. So I built this website called Primal Scheme, which is a music pun, and on the band Primal Scream, and Ollie Pybus, who's pretty young at heart, decided to make a sort of spoof logo for the website, which looks like one of their album covers. and basically, what this website, what the tool does is it generates PCR primers that tile across a viral genome and automates the design of these regions and these primers, basically. And it was all done in mind with making multiplex PCR work. So in order to do that, you can put each alternating region in the same reaction, because if you put overlapping ones in the same reaction, then you just get a short sort of product between the two. So so with two reactions, you can get the whole genome, which has got like 16 or 18 regions per reaction. And this is a diagram showing a couple of those schemes which we designed, Zika and chikungunya. And what we found was that it actually worked really well now, with the primers designed correctly for high annealing temperatures, so that they were less likely to interact with the host human DNA. In the single round of PCR, we were able to get that much coverage of the genome from those two reaction products pooled. And then we wrote a tool which normalized the coverage. And if you normalize the coverage, then you get something which looks pretty good like that. And that shows from a CT, these plots here for are the genome coverage of a CT33 and a CT36. So between sort of 10 and 100 virus copies per microliter being amplified properly and therefore being able to be sequenced. So we were very happy with that. And then I made another trip back to Brazil for a third time, and we used the new protocol and we managed to smash out about 50 genomes, which was a relief, I have to say. And then the phylogeneticists got to work, Ollie Pybus and Nuno Faria in Oxford, and produced this tree which showed that there were basically that Zika had been circulating cryptically in Brazil for a lot longer than what people thought, and that due to the fairly mild symptoms and similarity to other arbovirus-like infections like dengue, it hadn't been picked up for at least a year after it had been introduced, and it was probably introduced into North Brazil, and there were these multiple clades which now existed in Brazil, which were northeast, southeast clade, and then another one down there. So this is a big figure showing all the genome coverage that we managed to get with the Amplicon scheme and how that linked to CT. So there were still some samples which were unamplifiable due to like degradation and the diversity across the genome. And these, they were able to date the introductions into South America, Central America, and the Caribbean using their model. And this has now been published, I didn't put it in, but this is now was published a couple of months ago, and in a Zika special edition of Nature, which had three papers in, all of which used our amplification protocol. One from the Broads, one from Scripps, and our one. And it just showed that the benefit of being able to share that protocol, putting that protocol on GitHub, meant that people were able to get their hands on something which worked immediately, basically months before publication, and that facilitated three different papers. So, in conclusion, mobile sequencing is already here, and it's been demonstrated on a number of occasions. The sample preparation is the biggest problem to mobile sequencing. The actual ability to take the MinION and do things in different environments is not really a problem. It's the accompanying equipment and reagents and all that sort of stuff, and the sample prep, working with very low titer viruses like Zika, are all the major challenges. And I've got, obviously, these are two enormous projects, and I've got a lot of acknowledgements here. There you go. Thank you very much.
Just a technical question. I can see how you do this wonderful sequencing. How did you actually get the Ebola safely? I mean, did you get the RNA?
So the European Mobile Labs, as part of their equipment that they deploy to an ongoing outbreak, they have flexible film isolators, which are not actually containment for devices,
okay.
But they, you know, it's the best that they could do at the in the conditions. So they fold down, and they've got like a pass box on one side and gloves on the front, and you do it with a portable isolator, basically. And you make it safe by adding AVL, which is like a lysis buffer, and ethanol to the sample to denature the virus, and then after that you assume it's safe, and we work with the RNA on the bench.
So you just got the RNA though?
Yeah. I didn't go anywhere near the treatment center.
So what is it that's being put on the
ends of the DNA, either by ligation or transposase, that's encouraging the DNA to interact with the pore?
It's quite a complicated adapter, which has got the motor, which is on a binding site, which is needed for the progressivity. There's an abasic site which creates, so there's a base missing, which creates a spike, which is then recognized by as a read start by the software. And there's also a DNA backbone, which is thinner, so it's more likely to thread into the pore on the very end.
So basically putting a helicase on your piece of DNA, and what attracts the helicase to the pore?
The pore, nothing really. The end, the DNA, it interacts. If a molecule, ligand molecule, interacts with the pore, it will get sucked in, and then the protein will end up on top of the pore, slowing it down.
But it's basically just a random pollution at that point.
Yeah.
Thank you.
To what extent are polymorphisms a problem with your PCR amplification?
Polymorphisms, as in the mutations underneath the primer binding site.
Yeah, exactly.
You can probably tolerate the odd mismatch, but the major limitation of any amplicon approach is that it doesn't work on viruses that are too divergent and have too many mismatches. So we basically try to design schemes which will work for a certain lineage, basically. And if it's more than maybe 5 to 10% nucleotide diverged, then we have to design another scheme.
So suppose you have like a much larger sample, like you've only talked about two viruses today. Like, is there ever a case where a single sample can't be finished in a flow cell before the flow cell degrades completely? Right, like where like you actually need multiple flow cell runs.
We did the multiple flow cell runs for the human genome.
Okay.
So we generated 90 or 100 gigs of data from like 29 flow cells or something like that.
So the way you partition is actually partition amplicons? Like, I guess, like, I'm trying to understand, like...
amplicons. I think with amplicons, there would always be enough sequencing capacity. The problem would be generating the amplicons in the first place. That would be the bottleneck. There's only so many PCR primers you can put into a PCR reaction. We've tested up to about 50, and it works reasonably well. But I think it's very easy to sequence those 50 products to high coverage on one flow cell, even with multiplexing. I think the PCR is more likely to break down before you didn't sequence it all.
And I guess a related question, so going back to your like the Rumsfeld index thing that you were talking about, so suppose you have a very low spiked sample, right? So suppose you take E. coli genome and you spike a small amount of something. How small can you go before you're reliably capable of pulling out all DNA molecules in the soup that you add? Because presumably it's like not completely all the DNA that you add to the flow cell are not all sequenced.
No.
There's some limit to the pore.
Probably function. A very small proportion are actually sequenced, yeah.
So I guess like, do you have an estimate of like how abundant must your sample of interest be?
So definitely only a very small percent of the molecules that are on the flow cell ever interact with the pore and are therefore sequenced. It's, you know, fractions of, it may be 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 or 1 in 1 million, something like that. The abundance, the minimum abundance is determined by how much coverage you need. So you might be able, if you had a sample with 1 in 1 million reads, get a million reads, you only get one in that on target. It's not really very useful. You can't really do anything with one read. So, the things that we can do are with clinical metagenomics are things like urine and CSF, which have fairly small amounts of human host contamination. Things we can't do are things like tissue and blood.
Thank you.